It was obvious that he didn't really want anything to do with her, but boy, she was just hanging on so tight. God forbid he should know what would happen to her. And so, and then she got the letter. I mean, he didn't even have the nerve to sit down and talk to her face. He wrote her a letter. And she came over to my house with this letter, and she read me this letter, and it was horrific. You've never wrote such garbage, such crap that this guy dumped on her. And it, but at the end of the letter, and I don't know if this was sarcastic or not, but he signed the end of the letter, "Love, Bob." And well, that's all she picked up on. That's all she picked up on. All this garbage, all the terrible names he called her, all the terrible thoughts he had about her, all the terrible opinions he had about her, he read nothing because she picked up on the "love, Bob" part. You know, because it's denial. You don't want to see what you don't want to see. You know, and no amount of anything could make her see it. You know, so you got to, you know, yeah, just give her a hug, tell her I love her, tell her to keep coming back. You know, and she, because you got to walk through whatever pain you got to walk until you let the light in, until you let the truth in. You know, and you got to make sense of the craziness. And, you know, and the bottom line is denial keeps out the truth. It just keeps the truth out of your life. You know, and why? Because the family disease of alcoholism can't live in your family if there's truth. You know, the disease cannot perpetuate, you know, if one of you isn't focused on the truth. You got to be focused on the truth. And that's the big deal for me. And there was a couple pages I wanted to read out of, this is now like my favorite book in the entire world because there's just, I don't know why, again, I've gone through so much of the literature and so much of it has meant so much to me. But this book, when it first came out, I didn't like it. I was mad at it because they said when I was at our group, one of our district meetings or whatever, apparently when the book first came out, the stories in the back, are, you know, even though, you know, whenever they're writing a new book, they ask you to send stories in so that they can include them in the back. Well, apparently, when they edited the book, they did blended stories, which means they took part of my story, and they took part of your story, and they took part of your story to make, you know, to make it a little bit more interesting, and or what they thought was more interesting. And, of course, then my thing was, blasphemy, you know, this is terrible. Look, don't read, you know, because, again, I have strong opinions about whatever and stuff like that. But then I went to a meeting and someone didn't know about the blended story thing, didn't know about my opinion about how bad the blue book was, and they were leading the meeting on a particular part of the blue book, which to me was absolutely profound, and for whatever reason I got a lot out of it that day. And so what I do is I read the first part of the book, you know, the part of the book that talks about how Al-Anon works, because that isn't a blended story, it's the truth. And I know that New York put out a letter saying that they, you know, and I guess they've since revised it in the newer editions and they put the stories back as they were originally written. But this book has just helped me immensely in a lot of areas. And so there was a few things I wanted to highlight in here, you know, talking about experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, part of it's about becoming aware. You know, it says sometimes we don't recognize alcoholism even when it's staring us in the face. Having lived with the drinking for many years, we may have accepted it as normal and never felt overly concerned. Perhaps we envisioned alcoholics as filthy, ragclad derelicts and never considered that our well-kempt, successful friend or relative might be an alcoholic. Even if his or her drinking obviously is excessive, it never occurred to us that reactions to a long-forgotten alcoholic relative could have an effect on everyday lives year later, or that we could be adversely affected by relationships with a sober alcoholic. Illusions about alcoholism abound, and most of us simply were not aware of the nature of the disease or its impact on us. The families and friends of alcoholics, ignorance is neither a sin nor a crime, but it is an obstacle to seeing our situation realistically. Perhaps we were aware of the alcoholic's denial, but never realized that it could be a characteristic of everyone who was affected by the disease. Just as many alcoholics insist that they don't have a problem and refuse to talk about their drinking, many friends and family members do not acknowledge that any problems exist. We truly cannot see, hear, feel, or otherwise perceive what may be readily apparent to others. Ironically, because our entire lives are wrapped up into the disease of alcoholism, we can fail to notice its presence. And one time when I was really new in Al-Anon, my friend Crazy Jane, he used to talk all over, you know, the area and go to all kinds of different meetings and talk. And I was in Al-Anon but a few months, and he asked me to go one day with him and be the 10-minute speaker. And, well, you know, so, I mean, I'm new in Al-Anon. I don't know what you're supposed to talk about. So I talk about how well I covered up the alcoholism from all our family and friends, because I'm new and I think you're supposed to brag about that stuff. You know, I don't know. That's, you know, again, that's the knowledge that I had about it. So my 10 minutes, I talked how well I hid the alcoholism from all of our family and friends. And then when my 10 minutes was up, Gene, who goes to give his, you know, little Al-Anon talk, gets up there and he goes, you know, the only people that didn't know there was a disease of alcoholism in Butch and Larsine's house were Butch and Larsine. You know, and that's the absolute positive truth. You know, what was so readily apparent to so many other well-meaning people who may have well tried to point it out to us, who may have been there to try and help us, you know, just totally because it wasn't, you know, because we don't see. And you don't see and you don't hear until you see and you hear. And that's the bottom line. You get here when you get here. You know, and how we're all affected is also different. You know, my experiences are mine. Yours might be entirely different. But I look at alcoholism, it's kind of like going to the Grand Canyon. You know, if you've been to the Grand Canyon, you know, you've been to the Grand Canyon, you know, you never forget you were there. Now, some people just go for the day. You know, some people go for a week or two. You know, some people just go to the rim and look down. You know, some people actually are stupid enough to hike down to the bottom, you know, and do all that stuff. You know, but again, that to me is the disease of alcoholism. You know, it doesn't matter how you're affected, whether you're married to it, the child of it, you know, whether it's affected your whole entire life, whether it's just affected portions of it. Once you've been there, you've been there. You know, and that's the thread that just kind of binds us all together, that makes, you know, people that maybe, you know, maybe there's nothing else in our life that's similar or alike, but yet, you know, when we talk about how we've been affected by the disease of alcoholism, it amazes me, you know, how there's this just bond right away. You know, how I get off an airplane and get in a car, you know, with Margaret and Joyce here, you know, and the next minute, you know, within time, you know, we're talking about, you know, intimate things that are going on in my life, yet I just spent 3 hours between two guys on an airplane who didn't notice I had a bloody nose. You know, I mean, you know, but I mean, again, that's just, you know, that's just what happens here. You know, the real magic and the healing that gets to happen for us in these rooms. And so anyway, you know, and then I wanted, after I, you know, and that was kind of like the experience part of what I wanted to talk, you know, and then, you know, the next thing, you know, was the strength, and that's like what happened. You know, and what happened for me, you know, of course, is getting to come to Al-Anon. That's what happened for me. You know, and the first part of me getting to come to Al-Anon, surrender. And absolutely, positively, you know, one of the neatest things that, you know, happens for me. And surrender is really difficult for me. Why? Because I'm from the Army, and we don't surrender. Surrender, I grew up, surrender is a bad word in the Army. Ooh, surrender is not good. And it means, because surrender to me, again, one more time, my definition, surrender means, you know, I lose, you win. You know, and that's not going to happen. You know, I was sharing this morning, you know, people used to ask me sometimes, you know, when Butch was so bad, why didn't you just divorce him? You know, and I was like, and let him win? You know, the only way he's getting out of here is feet first, you know, because, I mean, I will be the ultimate victor. You know, and one more time, I look up the definition of surrender, and it's the action of yielding one's person or giving up the possession of something, especially into the power of another. You know, and when I found out the true definition of surrender, what's it about? It's about turning my will and my life over to the care of God. You know, having God be in charge of your life, that's a good thing. You know, no matter what walk of life you're coming from, that is a good thing. You know, and again, in going to those first meetings, how hard it was for me to walk into those meetings. And it took 3 times for me to come to Al-Anon. You know, I told you last night about the first time I came. I wanted you to tell me how to get him to stop drinking. That's all I was interested in, the only information I wanted to know. You know, the second time I came to Al-Anon, it was only because, you know, because they told me I had to go to an Al-Anon meeting because he was getting sober. You know, and I told you what I told them. You know, I got him sober and I don't need you now. You know, and that was the end of, you know, I don't need you people at all. You know, and the third time I came, it was, again, for the right reason. I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, because I wanted to know how to turn it off. I just wanted to know how to turn off all the bad feelings. And, you know, and I kind of liken the 3 times I heard this story one time, you know, and again, you know, and I believe all 3 times God was throwing out the rescue line to me. All 3 times, but I rejected it. And there's the story about this minister, and he's, and he lives out in the woods, and this horrific rainstorm started, and there's starting to be floods, and these rangers come by in the truck, and they go to the minister, you know, why don't you come with us, and we're going to take you up the higher ground, because this looks like it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And the minister says, no, I have a great faith in God, and I know that God's going to look out for me. You know, and so, I don't know, another day later, you know, now the waters, you know, the first floor of his house is covered. He's on the second floor of his house, and here come the rangers by, and they're in a boat this time, and they motorboat up to him, and they go, you know, you really... And, you know, so we can get, you know, we're going to get you to higher ground and you'll be safe. And he goes, God will watch out for me. You know, I am his servant. He will take care of me. You know, and then, you know, one more time, you know, another day goes by. Now the minister's on the roof of his house, you know, and here comes the rangers in a helicopter, a rescue helicopter, you know, and they lower the lifeline to him. And he refuses to get on. God will not forsake me. I am fine. So... next thing you know, here's the minister up at the pearly gates, and there he's standing before his maker, and he can't believe that he has died, and he's very upset with God, and he says to God, You know, why did you forsake me? I have been your servant and prayed to you and been faithful to you and let you let me drown. And God says, what the heck do you want from me? I sent a truck, a boat, and a helicopter. You know, and that's kind of been the deal for me. You know, I expect the big ba-boom, you know, message from God. And that's not the way that it works. Sometimes it comes in a truck, sometimes it comes in a boat, and sometimes it comes in a helicopter. But if I'm not going to pay attention to the rescue vehicle that's being sent my way, and then still criticize God for not being there, because I don't recognize the deal. And that's why, you know, and it takes strength to surrender. It absolutely positively does. You know, in one of our books, and I can't remember which one it does, you know, it talks about, you know, how much we fight, you know, for the alcoholic, you know, and it talks about the worthy goal, you know, that we've made this be our worthy goal. And, you know, and the deal is it's not my goal. My husband's life is his life. You know, my dad's life was his life. You know, that's his goal, and he's the one who's got to make his own goals. You know, and surrender, too, for me is about steps 1, 2, and 3. You know, you just got to work those first 3 steps. It's about turning it over, letting it go, letting somebody else be in charge. You know, that's the deal. There's certain things that I can take care of. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And then there's things that I can't. You know, and the other thing that was a huge deal for me, again, in what happened and where I get my strength from, sponsorship. I mean, I can't say enough good things about sponsorship. I mean, I couldn't live without a sponsor. I have to have a sponsor. Why? Because left to my own devices, I'm a crazy woman. At any given time, I talk to my sponsor every day. Every day I talk to my sponsor. It's just part of the deal for me, and it just keeps me focused and keeps me on track of where I'm supposed to be. You know, and why do I need a sponsor in Al-Anon? I'll tell you why, because I'm good at faking it. I'm really good at faking it. I can bluff my way through just about anything, pretty much. And why? Because I can talk fast, da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, and if you dazzle them with stuff like that, you know, they kind of just let you move on along the way or whatever. But that's why. I know that I'm good at faking it, you know. So I need a sponsor to show me the way to go. I need to go to her and go, I don't know what to do. I'm afraid. You know, like I shared last night about, you know, when my grandson was born. You know, I'm sitting there, and I'm at this dinner, and they're having this nice little speaker dinner thing going on, and I'm with these people who are happy to have me here. You know, who are, you know, and they're the start of their convention and they're happy and stuff like that. And I'm looking at these people and I resent them. I resent that I have to be there and I'm angry. So I do what I've been taught to do here. I get up and I go and I have my cell phone and I go out and I call my sponsor and I tell her how I'm feeling and how frustrated I am because I don't understand, because I don't have the balance in my life. You know, when are you there for Al-Anon and when are you there for your family? You know, where's the deal here? So I got to talk with someone else, reason things out. You know, and like I said, she put me on the straight and narrow. Larsine, did you turn your will and your life over to the care of God today? Then you are exactly where you are supposed to be. You know, and she just gave me those words that I needed to hear. Because what happened to me was I wasn't where I wanted to be, so that family disease, that negative disease of alcoholism, which is always residing in the back of my head, just waits for me. Just waits for me to be just a little bit weak and just chomps right down on me. You know, but now I have the tools. When I feel the anger, the resentment, any of those feelings come up, I call my sponsor. I call my sponsor right away. And sometimes she tells me, you know, you have every right in the world to be mad. And sometimes I don't. You know, and then we talk about it, and we reason things out, and I get it back into perspective. You know, sometimes she gives me a little assignment. Sometimes she doesn't have to. Sometimes just in the talking is what fixes it for me. But, you know, like I say, it's just been, you know, I've had 2 sponsors. My first sponsor, which I told you about last night, Jeannie, I had her up until she died. And she died of liver cancer, which really pissed her off. You know, this is not a way for an Al-Anon to go. This is not the way an Al-Anon has to go. And she was very, very angry about it. You know, but again, I tell you what I love the most about both of my sponsors is they are human beings. They are human beings. You know, they never portrayed themselves to be saints to me. You know, they told me about their goofy stuff that they would do, you know, or when they were having a bad day. You know, sometimes I'd call them with my bad day, and their day was way worse. You know, we'd end up talking about them the whole conversation or whatever. But my sponsors have been human beings, working this program to the best of their ability, giving me what they had to give, you know, when I needed it. And both my sponsors are different. I mean, they're both very, very different people, you know. And I love the stuff that I hear people... Well, you know, people say, oh, my sponsor told me this, my sponsor told me that. Last week I was at a meeting and someone said, you know, I told my sponsor I was walking through hell. And my sponsor said, keep on walking. You know, and I mean, sometimes the advice is just that simple. Just that simple. Because sometimes you got to walk through hell. Sometimes you just got to go there. You know, but that's the deal. You don't have to linger. You know, keep on walking. Just keep on going until you're through the deal, you know. And picking a sponsor, you know. You just need to pick someone who, you know, it doesn't take very long. Go to a few meetings, hear people share. You know, you're going to hear it. When you're constantly drawn to that person sharing, you know, then that's the person you need to ask to be your sponsor. It's just really that simple. It's not that big complicated of a deal. You know, and You know, and it's the same way when people ask me to be their sponsor, I tell them I'm happy to do it. You know, but if things change down the road a little bit or whatever, or you're coming or I'm not giving you what you need anymore or something, feel free. Feel absolutely positively free to pick someone else, because I'd rather you got a new sponsor than you quit coming down on. You know, you we grow, you know, in different ways and along different roads. I don't know what your path is, you know. And if I get to walk part of it along the way with you, wonderful, you know. But if you got to go with someone else down another part of it, then so be it. You know, it's not about me. It's not about, you know, how my feelings are going to be or whatever. It's about you getting well in the program, whatever way that it takes for you to get well. And I know people that burn through sponsors. I know people that got lots of sponsors. Because they got lots of sponsors, because if sponsor A doesn't say what they want them to say, then they call sponsor B. And then they call sponsor C, you know, and so on and so on and so on. And we joke about it all the time. You know, we talk about, we got booger sponsors. You know, we got, sponsors that tell you how to wipe your butt. You know, I mean, you can have every kind of sponsor you want in the world, because I hear people say it. I've got a spiritual sponsor. I've got a step sponsor. I've got a service sponsor, you know, and stuff like that. And again, you know, for me, having one sponsor has really been the deal, because there's one person that I go to all the time. Doesn't mean I don't go to other people and ask their experience, strength, and hope. My sponsor doesn't tell me I can't talk to other people on the phone. That's not what part of the deal is. Again, if I'm doing something and I don't know, my sponsor doesn't have any experience. I go talk to somebody else about it. And even if my sponsor doesn't, maybe I want someone else's perspective on it as well. I feel really free to do that, because that's the freedom the program gives you. No one's in charge of you. You know, sponsors are strictly, they're just guides to take you through the steps. It's kind of like going to a really weird foreign country, and coming into Al-Anon is like a weird foreign country. I mean, let's face it, it's just like a weird foreign country here. You know, we're talking stuff, you walk into your first Al-Anon meeting and people are laughing, what the heck is that? You know, this is not funny. This is serious, dead, serious stuff, you know. And, and that's how I, you know, what are they laughing for? It must not be serious for them, you know. And that's why you have a sponsor. It's just like when you go to a different country, you don't know the customs. You don't know what's going on. A sponsor takes you through that. You know, we had a girl, she was coming to Al-Anon for about 3 or 4 months. And one time she says at the meeting how her husband was mad at her because she was just making her side of the bed. You know, because she had heard people share, make just your side of the bed. You know, and so she literally took that home. She didn't ask anybody about it, and then wonders why her husband's mad at Al-Anon. You know, I mean, it's just like, well, no, we don't really mean that literally. You know, and again, you know, you got to ask people when you don't know, when it doesn't make sense, ask your sponsor what that means. You know, you need to do it. And again, and like my sponsors, you know, Jeannie, like I said, you know, she had one adopted son who was grown when I asked her to be my sponsor. And this was an addict kid and an alcoholic kid. And, you know, and when my boys started going through troubles with drugs and alcohol and stuff started happening to them, Jeannie absolutely refused to talk to me about it. Because she was a total enabler of her son. And she knew it. You know, and she knew that she had no experience, strength, and hope to give me on that. And that's what she would tell me. I can't help you there. I couldn't help myself there. With the best help that I got from my sponsor, you know, that you know the things that I've done, you know, to bail him out and keep him out of trouble, you know, and the things that I know that I shouldn't have done. You know, and so she insisted that I talk to other people, you know, who were a little bit better at the tough love thing, you know. And I don't even like to call it tough love. It's unconditional love. That's really what it is, you know. And again, you know, how they were with me, you know, and Carol, you know, my favorite thing Carol's telling me one day, and this was when Carol was going through a terrible time. Her husband was dying. He'd had a lung transplant, and he was dying from lung cancer, and her nerves were shot, and her neighbor, she had a funky neighbor, just one of them weird neighbors, and her neighbor used to like to take little sticks and stick them in the grass on down the driveway property line, and then she would take garbage bags, those plastic garbage bags, and tie them to the top of the sticks. Now, I don't know what this was all about, but it drove Carol absolutely nuts. But the sticks were on her neighbor's property side, even though Carol could see the sticks from her property side. And, you know, and I was over at her house a lot, and we would always whatever. Well, one day after she came home to shower, after she'd been with Dick all day at the hospital, there she was again, replacing the sticks with new sticks and new garbage bags. Carol was watering the grass and then turned around and watered her neighbor. You know, I mean, she could take it no more. And, now, there's nothing loving and kind about it, you know. I mean, she just snapped that day. She just snapped that day. And so her neighbor took a bath. And you know, but when she shared it at the meeting, we just all roared, you know, and stuff. Because it's not about doing it perfectly all the time. You know, it's about doing the best that we can. And some days you're going to snap. And boy, don't you need a sponsor then. You just need someone to just hug you and tell you it's okay. You know, they're not going to tell you what you did was right, you know, or whatever. That's the best thing about Al-Anon to me in the world. You can come in and you can make the biggest major slips in the entire universe here. And we'll just sit there. Keep coming back. We love you. You know, I mean, that's the deal here. That is the deal here. You can't do anything that they go, you must now leave. You have broken the total Al-Anon commandments. You know, that does not happen here, no matter what. You know, we love you unconditionally. And that's why it's so important for me to keep coming here, because I get that from you guys. Sometimes I just mess it up so big. I just mess it up so big. And I know I've messed it up, and I can't undo it, because the mess is made. You know, but you guys love me back to good health again. Okay, so we start from here. We start from here and we go forward. You know, and that's the deal. And sometimes you got to start from here when you're 1 year. Sometimes you got to start from here when you're 30 years. It doesn't matter. Sometimes you just got to just start right from here. And you can always do that in these rooms. You know, and a sponsor lets you do that. You know, my sponsor only has one rule, and that's call before you shoot. You know, because she doesn't want any of us going to jail. You know, but, you know, that's the only rule, you know, that she really has. So anyway, I see it's coming up on lunchtime, so I'm going to kind of stop it right here, and then I guess we'll just see y'all back here at 1:30 when we resume the group. That's good. Hi, everybody. My name is Larsine. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Basically, I want to thank you guys for coming back. It's always the big fair. They're all left. They've all gone shopping and doing something more fun than that. I wanted to start off this afternoon session. My sponsor let me borrow this book from her, and it's one of our original like pieces of literature, one of the first books that came out. It was The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage. And this book was published in 1967. And there is a chapter in here that we all really enjoy reading nowadays. It's actually pretty funny. The way it used to be. Hang on here, let me find it. And it's called, I gotta put my glasses on here, Checklists to Review Once in a While. And this is the AM division. This is what you're supposed to review in the morning. And this is Al-Anon conference approved literature. Number one. Do you get breakfast for your husband? Number two, is it a good breakfast for a man about to do a day's work? Three, do you look human in the morning? Overnight hair, makeup, remnants, hair curlers, crumpled nightie, house coats, or last week's apron? Number four, do you use breakfast time to review his misbehavior or to let him know how overworked you are? Number five, do you want him to look forward to coming home in the evenings? Number six, if he's in a sour mood, can you keep cheerful inside yourself and not resent it? Number seven, if he's braced for your verbal assault, can you bear to disappoint him? Number eight, do you remind him of the chores he failed to do so they'll nag on his mind all day at work? Number nine, wouldn't you rather have him go off to work in a reasonably good frame of mind? Now, see, and now in my group, when we go over the AM division, we're like, hell, he wasn't even there for breakfast, you know. This is the PM division. Number 10, did you run out to the supermarket or the delicatessen 10 minutes before he was due home to scare up something to eat? 11, was whatever kept you from planning to cook a good dinner important enough to warrant such emergency measures? 12, do you welcome him when he comes home so he really feels you're glad he's back? 13, did you ask him about his day and listen? 14, do you have a barrage of troubles to greet him with? All your frustrations, the children's misbehavior, the neighbors, gossip about who did what to whom? 15, do you try to make your talk cheerful and lighthearted, even if you've had an awful day? 16, do you look nice when he comes home? A subtle compliment to him? Yeah, I know, it's like... Obviously, they have not read New Women magazine. 17, if he's tired or grumpy, do you stampede him with the plans for the evening, movies, visits, visitors, errands, chores? 18, if he's been drinking, do you sound the war trumpet and start a fight or whine and weep or sulk? Or do you act as though it didn't make the least difference to you and try to feel that way inside? 19, if he doesn't come home for dinner, do you sit and worry, or do you remember there's nothing you can do about it and try to make an interesting evening for yourself? And this, it just keeps on getting better. The personal appearance division. No, this is my favorite one. How much did you weigh before you were married? How much now? 21, do you think you're as attractive as you were when you were going steady? Could you improve your figure, your complexion, your posture, your hairdo, your clothes?
22, do you let your frustrations keep you from A, keeping yourself well-groomed, B, getting enough rest, or C, eating properly? D, getting exercise and fresh air, E, finding new ways of looking smart? Now, see, that was my problem. He always said I looked too smart. 23, if you answer no to more than one part of question 22, why? No time, don't care anymore, want to look like the martyr you feel, don't like yourself, want to make him feel responsible. And now there's the use of time division. If you answered yes to question 23A, why? Now, see, you can tell this is an Al-Anon question, because we know we'll remember what 23A was. Was it because you were too busy visiting neighbors for long chats? Too much occupied with scrubbing the house, laundry, sewing, going to work to pay the bills? Did you ever try dividing up your time into manageable segments? A, for housekeeping, shopping, meal planning, laundry, cooking? And B, allow time for the recreation you need, bowling, movies, gardening, entertaining, reading, volunteer work, Al-Anon. If your husband doesn't do a home job he'd planned to do or left it unfinished, what do you do? A, nag. B, leave the ladder in the paint pot in the middle of the floor. Or C, do it yourself and point out your halo to him. And then 27 is the children division. Does the care of your children come under the headings of first things first? Do you minimize the effects of family conflicts by protecting them with your love and concern? Do you take your frustrations out on them? Do you resent it when they seem more attached to the alcoholic than to you, or do you try to figure out why? Can you make a sizable list of the things you do to make them feel loved and secure, of the things you do even out of desperation to alienate and confuse them? Are you too busy to know what they're doing, where they are, who their companions are, to give them ample time and guidance and instruction to encourage and supervise their reading? If you have felt driven to take a job to make up for the lack of sufficient income, have you considered A, the net profit after you've paid someone to take care of them, B, the incalculable cost of their being deprived of mothering? See, my kids were grateful I had a job. They got a break. C, the possibility that your spouse might be relieved at your taking over his responsibility or that he might resent your assuming his role as breadwinner. And anyway, that's just some of the early literature that we had. And I just, every time, you know, we read this, and a lot of times at our conferences during the luncheon, we'll read this, you know, just to kind of remind us a little bit about how far we've really come in some of our literature. And, and the other part of this thing, too, is that, you know, at the beginning, you know, we all laughed and thought, oh, this was horrible. This is terrible. But, you know, I guess back in that time, you know, that's what, you know, wives stayed home, and those were the things you do. And when you really read between the lines here, one more time, I think what the literature's telling us to do, even back then, even though it seems like, oh, my gosh, you know, it was the deal about doing what's in front of you to do. What was your job to do? You know, ignore, you know, the drinking, look past the drinking, and the bottom line is, you know, taking charge and doing what you're supposed to do. You know, and they didn't have a lot of printed stuff back then. Another piece that she gave me that I really enjoy is this little booklet, and I have no idea when it was published, but they just put together their own little thing. This was out of Long Beach, California, and it's Alcoholism, the Family Disease, and they just had, like, the do's and don'ts in here and a couple little personal stories and there is a way out and a couple of other things. But they have the qualification questions in here to test yourself to see if you need this design for living. And these are the questions you're supposed to, like the AAs have the 20 questions, you know, these are the questions for the Al-Anons. Number one, are you unhappy? Number two, are you very nervous? Has worry become a habit? Is your general health on the decline? Is your home life unpleasant? Have you thought of separation? Are you easily upset? Do you seek to avoid people? Is the circle of your friends decreasing? Do you have unpleasant dreams? Do you feel sick mentally, physically, and spiritually? Do you feel insecure, frustrated, tense, degraded, afraid, ashamed, uncertain, or dismayed? Do you pull into your shell like a turtle to hide your thoughts and feelings? Are you secretly critical of others? Do you have twitching of facial muscles about the eyes? I know. Yeah, the Al-Anon twitch thing we got going. Do you perspire profusely when worried? Do you have palpitations of the heart or pain in the left side of the chest, which is sometimes mistaken for heart trouble? And then my very favorite, the last one. Do you have digestive disturbances, such as a knot in the stomach or constipation or diarrhea or both alternately? If your answer is yes to many of these questions, the family disease called alcoholism is hurting you, and this design for living can help you. So anyway, I just kind of wanted to bring those two kind of pieces of literature because I just thought they were just, they're just fabulous stuff. And I really like the old literature and you know, and not, of course, compared to the literature that we have today, as you guys well know, you know, the stuff that's back there and, you know, and the stuff that's available to us, all the different pamphlets. You know, I forget how many hundreds of pieces of literature that there are out there. But, you know, I'm really grateful. When I first came into Al-Anon, they had just published the 12 and 12. That was like the big deal. And I remember going to my first meetings and how excited they were, and them telling me how lucky I was, because there wasn't a 12 and 12 book, you know, prior to, and I came in 1982, so I guess there wasn't a book prior to that that discussed, you know, working the 12 steps and the 12 traditions for Al-Anon. And I am really, really grateful for the literature, and it's a big part of the strength that I get and the recovery that I get. And my sponsors were really big on the literature, you know. Like I say, when I came to my first meetings, you know, when they said, and I said, what do we do here? You know, they said, we go to meetings, we get a sponsor, we work the steps, we read the literature. You know, that's like part of my four things that I have to do for me to qualify to be a member of Al-Anon, and the literature really is a very helpful, wonderful thing. But anyway, when we kind of left off, I kind of left off in the sponsor part of the deal, and I was pretty much through most of what I really wanted to share about that. You know, but basically, one more time, you know, the big thing about a sponsor for me is I need someone to tell me when I'm full of crap. You know, it's just really important for me to have that in my life. And, you know, because a lot of times I think I'm not, and I think I'm justified in what's going on. And I love the way that my sponsors point that out to me. And the really beautiful thing about that is when they point out to me, you know, my defects of character, they've never done it in a way that makes me feel bad about myself. You know, they start to relate to me something that they did or something similar that happened to them, and that it, maybe I might look at it from this perspective. You know, and it's really great when someone can, you know, kind of take apart your story, you know, the thing you've made up in your head, and not make you feel bad about it. You know, and I just feel wonderful after I talk to them about something because they've given me another way to look at it. You know, and you know, things a sponsor is not, you know, that I have learned here and people want to use them for. You know, a sponsor is not a bank or financial institution. We don't lend money here. We don't try and bail people out of other people. You know, I've seen some of that stuff go on. And, you know, and I found from our own, you know, and the same thing about women sponsor women and men sponsor men. You know, there's reasons for those kinds of things. And I know that it's been, you know, like a lot of men have had to come in. And the pickings are a little bit harder for men, I guess, you know, because there's, you can look around the room today and see, you know, the difference between how many men there are in Al-Anon and how many women there are in Al-Anon. And, you know, and I've known men that have had selected women sponsors, but they've picked, you know, strong women that are in Al-Anon, and that's worked for them. And one more time, there's no really hard, fast rules. You have to do what's best for you. And but I know that, and I always love it when men talk about coming into Al-Anon. They either hate the fact that there are so many women there, or they love the fact that there are so many women there. You know, it's always one way or the other. And I love the men that are in Al-Anon. And I think it's just, you know, our Monday night group is a pretty large group, my home group. We have about, you know, a core group of between 50 and 75 people that come to that meeting. And we've got a strong contingency of men that are in that group. And when I say that, I mean like 20-25%, you know, are guys that come to our meeting. And I really love it. And, you know, and I understand, you know, in Al-Anon sometimes, you know, we have, you know, like there's men's stags and there's just women's meetings and all that kind of stuff. But I really like the blended meetings. I like the meetings when it's, you know, if there's no particular anything. It's just an Al-Anon meeting. There's no focus on the fact that your child's an alcoholic or you're married to an alcoholic or you're a man or you're a woman. You know, I love the blended meetings that are just an Al-Anon meeting because we're just talking about our experience, strength, and hope. And that's what you get. And then when it's an open blended meeting like that, you know, then it's not just, I'm not just hearing people that are living in the same situation that I am. I love hearing from men and hearing their perspective on what it's like. You know, it just opens up another window for me, another way for me to look at how they look at things. Helps me to understand my husband a little bit better and my sons a little bit better. You know, and the same thing, I hear men share the same thing, you know, when they hear a woman's perspective about how they look at things. You know, it's just one more opportunity for us to be able to look, you know, at things a little bit differently. And then my sponsor has this thing that she heard at a meeting that I just love, and it's just really the five words you need to be a good sponsor. And the five words are yes, no, whatever, really, and wow. You know, that pretty much will take you through whatever anybody calls you, you know. You know, because when the phone rings for me, and especially if someone's crying on the other end, you know, I don't know what's going on, so I just offer up that really quick prayer. You know, God, please help me to say what this person needs to have heard today, you know, so that they can go on or refer them to the right person that that they need to talk to. And but anyway, I just can't say enough good stuff about sponsorship. If you don't have one, I can't encourage you enough to get one. Even if you have to get someone and you say you're my temporary sponsor or whatever, it just makes such a big difference to have somebody to call, to have somebody to run the stuff by. We were talking a little bit earlier today, you know, about how many times, you know, you don't want to call your sponsor because you know your sponsor so well, you know what your sponsor's going to tell you. You know exactly what she's going to say, and therefore, you know, well, why should I call her? Because she's going to tell me this and I don't want to do it, is really what the bottom line is about that. And, you know, at least I know that that's the truth for me. You know, so like I say, I make a point about talking to my sponsor just about every single solitary day. And it's not a requirement. She's never made that be a requirement. It's just what's become a necessary thing for me. It's just part of my life, like it is to breathe and, you know, go to work or brush my teeth in the morning. You know, I need to touch base. And if I don't talk to my sponsor that day, there's not a day that goes by that I don't talk to somebody. I have so many friends in Al-Anon that I don't talk to somebody in the program. It's just the thing that keeps me centered and keeps me based. You know, and from sponsorship, I want to go in and talk about awareness. And awareness is a huge thing again, just a huge thing for me. Because awareness says that I have to acknowledge my part in what goes on in my life. And again, I can't emphasize enough, again, when you got an alcoholic doing this stuff all the time, sober or drunk, and, you know, they're just, whatever they're doing, you know, I my focus goes on them, and I forget about what my part is and what's going on here. And, you know, and for me, first of all, you know, the first strength I got was that realization that I'm on the wrong path. And I kind of liken it to like you're going hiking, you know, and you're hiking and you're hiking and you're hiking and you're not finding the place you're looking for, you know, and you're not finding the place you're looking for because you found out partway down this hiking thing that you're on the wrong trail. You know, and that's kind of how it is, like, to me, when you get on this, you know, I don't know when we get on the path of the family disease of alcoholism, but I got on this family disease path of alcoholism and don't know that I'm on the wrong path. And I just keep plowing ahead and plowing ahead and plowing ahead. And then when I have this realization and I found out about the disease of alcoholism and how I was affected by it, that was wonderful. I mean, there was no doubt. Thank you. Now I know. But that realization just tells me where I'm at. You know, I am still 20 miles, 50 miles, whatever it is, down the wrong path. The realization does not put you back where you should have been. You know, the deal is you got to turn around and go back the way you came. That's the only way to get back. You got to go back to where you made the wrong turn in the first place, you know, which is when we do our fourth step and our fifth step. You know, it's that, you know, the wreckage of our past, recognizing our part in what happened. You know, and that's how it was for me. I just had to do that. Now, and the deal for me is you know, I don't want to go back that way. You know, I've just already been that way. I don't want to have to turn and go back that way. I want shortcuts because I want to be well now. I have to know, okay, just tell me, I want to do all the 12 steps right today in a row. Let's just get it over with because I need to be well now. I have wasted all this time. Al-Anons hate to waste time. That just really bugs us. You know, so, but it's that realization that I have to turn around and go back. And the deal is when you try and take shortcuts, that's, you know, what you're doing is you're putting yourself on the wrong path again. You know, because you think there's a shorter way to get back to where you should have turned off. And there isn't. And the good news is, though, is the path you came down, it's already plowed because you've already walked that way. And you're going to meet plenty of people on the way back. You know, but you will get there. It's just one day at a time. Just one day at a time. You know, and how important is it to know the whys? That was a big deal for me. I don't know if it was a big deal for you guys, but I always want to know why. I always want to know, why is my husband alcoholic? How come her husband is an alcoholic? How come she gets all the money? I want to know that one. You know, how come they get a Mercedes-Benz, you know, and I've got this little fixer-upper car? You know, I want to know why all that stuff is going on. The bottom line is, I don't know why. You know, it's just the way the circumstances work out. Is it because someone's more deserving or less deserving? I don't believe that either. It's just the way that it is. And that wasn't a big deal for me. And then the whys also turns into the ifs. You know, I'm a big, you know, but what if? My whole life is based on what if this happens. That's why, like, in my purse I have so much stuff. Because what if? You know, I mean, and especially when I'm traveling, I'm a big what if person, you know, and stuff like that. That's why when I'm traveling, I keep clean underwear in my purse, you know, because what if my luggage gets lost? My luggage has never been lost, but I will be prepared, you know, and it's like, you know, my husband's always joking about all the garbage that's in my purse, and I tell him, if we're ever deserted in the desert, this purse will save our life. Trust me, you know, because I have every what if contingency in the world in there. You know, and for some, you know, and there is some good to planning, you know, knowing, taking in that some of these things may happen. There is some good that goes with that. It's like the same thing when my grandson was born. You know, I said how I had made this deal with God that this kid couldn't be born while I was gone, and it was. You know, and I found out later, of course, after I got back and I got to write about that, you know, what the deal was for me. Is I made a deal with God, but I forgot to do the other thing. I forgot to do the what's the worst that can happen. You know, now sometimes you have to ask yourself when you're making choices in your life, what's the worst thing that can happen? You know, and can I deal with that? Then you can go on from that point. You know, and I forgot to ask myself when this baby was about to be born, what's the worst that could happen? Well, the worst that could happen was that it could be born while I was out of town. Then what would you do? And see, I didn't make that plan. And so therefore, I was just totally caught off guard and not ready. So there's a certain amount of planning I think that's good to do. Because then I know, then I am prepared for that eventuality as much as you're capable of being prepared for that eventuality. But I was really big on all the what ifs and, you know, what if this happens and what if that happens? And then someone once told me, you know, because I was real big on the what if, and I guess I said it a lot, and they said, well, what if your uncle were a woman? He might be your aunt. You know, I mean, it's a possibility, you know, but again, you can't, you know, sometimes you just gotta, you know, we talk about, we suit up and we show up. That's just the deal. You just get up there, you know, and if I've done the things I'm supposed to do every day, if I've said my prayers, you know, I've read the morning meditations, done those kinds of things, then I am ready and I'm prepared for whatever eventuality. You know, and we talked about today, too. Sometimes what if you're not prepared? Some of the best times I've had in my life have been total surprises to me. When I let it happen, when I let it be fun. You know, when I broaden out that horizon and make it be a fun experience instead of, oh, it's not going exactly the way that I want it to be. Think about, you know, things that you've done. You know, most of us, when I think about vacations we've gone on or whatever, the vacations I remember are the ones that went totally amok. You know, way off of the plan. Way, you know, and I am a planner. We have a motorhome and we go camping, and I have, you know, my vacation books are legendary in my home. You know, when my boys were dating, you know, their girlfriends and stuff like that, they go, you got to see my mom's vacation books. Because I make notebooks with tabs, you know, of all the locations that we are going to. Now, we're camping. We're supposed to be off the cuff, you know, having a good time. That was the idea of the motorhome, going from place to place, not having to stay as long as we want. But I want to know where we're going. I want to know there's a campground there that meets my specifications. You know, I want to know there's clean toilets, clean bathrooms, and whatever, because I got a big thing about toilets and all that other kind of stuff. It's huge for me. And I'm not kidding. And then when we get to the location, you open up the tab book. I have exactly how many miles it is from point A to point B, how much miles I figure we will get per gallon, you know, where we will have to stop for gas. I mean, I'm not kidding. The vacation books are legendary. And then, you know, and then it's, you know, all the recreational facilities that are available to us, you know, at this particular location. And, you know, and again, that's how I plan all that kind of stuff. But the most fun vacations we've had is when there hasn't been anything that was in a vacation book or on the internet that I couldn't look up, that we just happened upon. You know, that those have been the things that have been the most fun. The vacations that have totally gone amok, you know, and because halfway through the program kicks in, you know, and I guess this is where we're supposed to be, and we'll make the best of it. This will be fun if I let it be fun. I have to remind myself all the time to let it be fun. You know, there's a lot of adventures that are out there if I'm just willing just to go with the flow. But if I want to feel like it's not going according to the plan, and you know when you plan something, planned vacations suck. There's just no better word for it, you know, when we have to go here and we have to go there and we have to see the second largest ball of twine in the world. You know, I mean, it's crazy, you know, and I have to step away from that. You know, we go hiking a lot, my husband and I. My sons no longer go hiking with their mother. Why? Because their mother lies. You know, because you know, especially teenage boys do not like to walk. It's like against the rules. They have to skateboard or ride a bike or do whatever, but they do not like to walk. And for me, only hike that's worth it is a day hike. And a day hike for me is 12, 14 miles, you know, which is way, way too much for those. So I tell those boys, it's 2 miles, you know. Because why? I want them to go, you know, and that's the bottom line. And I'll say whatever it is. So anyway, they quit going a long time ago. My husband, he's alcoholic and only has a couple brain cells. He forgets and goes with me. And my husband, when he goes hiking, now he's this laid-back, easy-going guy, and we go beautiful places, you know, Yosemite, Yellowstone, the Sequoias, I mean, spectacular, Big Sur, just beautiful, beautiful scenery. But I'm on a mission, because I have the hiking map. This is where we start, this is where we have to end, this is the time we have to be here so we can be back here before it's dark outside. So that means I don't care what the frick there is to look at. We're on a mission. And my husband, no, no. We'll come upon a pristine lake with wildflowers all around it. Nobody there with us. He wants to take off his shoes, put his feet in the water, and enjoy the day. This is not on the agenda. You know, I am sorry, because I'm looking at my watch, because it is so important for me to touch the wall, because I have said I have to touch the wall. You know, if we're on a 12-mile hike and there is something at the end of that hike, by God, we're going to touch it and we're going to be back. You know, and what happened one time is we were in Sequoia, my husband and I, and we just did a little, we had breakfast and just did this little weenie hike that was maybe 4 miles round trip. And there was supposed to be this waterfall, you know, at the end of the hike. And this is in late summer in Sequoia, so basically most of the water is dried up. And it was hot and humid and sticky and kind of raining and not raining. And it wasn't very pleasant of a hike. And we get to the waterfall. It was dry as a bone. There was no waterfall there, you know. So we start walking back. And on the walk back, we run across this grumpy old fart. I mean, just this grumpy old man. And he had his walking stick and just that. He had the look on his face. And he was just walking, you know. And then as he walks past us, he goes, "How much further is it?" You know, and I'm like, "Oh, you got about another 20, 25 minutes. Now, I didn't tell him the waterfall was dry because I knew it wouldn't matter to him. He had the look on his face. He had to touch the wall. Doesn't matter if there's anything to see or not. He's on a mission, and I understand that. You know, and we walk past him, and not 10 minutes goes by, and we come across another man who's just about the same age, another older man, and this guy has his shirt off, and he's got his walking stick. Big, huge grin on his face, you know, and he walks past my husband and I, and he says, "Beautiful day for a hike, isn't it?" You know, and after he walks past us, my husband turns to me, and he goes, "First man, destination-oriented. Second man, journey-oriented. Which guy do you want to be?" You know, and that was kind of my lesson that day, you know, because that's what I was. I was on a destination trip here, you know, and I don't want to be. It's a journey. It really is a journey. And how much stuff do I miss? Because I'm looking at my destination, and I'm missing the stuff. You know, I look back at these photo albums of these trips we went on, and my husband, you know, he's a big camera buff, and he takes tons and tons of pictures. And I'm amazed. I can't believe I was there, because I have a vacation book. That's all I'm looking at, you know, where we're supposed to go and what we're supposed to do next. I have to look at my vacation pictures to see where I've been. You know, this is, and that's not how I want to be. I want to close my mind and my eyes and look back in my memory and see where I've been. I don't want to have to rely on pictures to remind me of that, you know, because I was too busy looking. You know, and that stuff I learned from the alcoholic, him working his program, living one day at a time. The concepts that are very, very difficult for me, you know, but I've got to learn those. And it's all been about awareness and getting there that way. You know, the next thing for me is willingness, you know, and again, I talked about it last night. You have to have some willingness. You just have to have some willingness, and to get past the fear, to get past all that stuff that'll change your life, because nothing's going to change unless you have some willingness to do something different. The Alateens in our area have SCAC, which is the Southern California Alateen Conference, and because it's Alateen, you know, they don't have a lot of funds at their disposal, and so the Al-Anons in our area, we used to do a fundraiser thing for them, and we do a spaghetti dinner speaker night thing, and we charge people, and then all the proceeds would go to help pay for SCAC, and there was about six or seven of us that were on the committee one night putting the meeting on, and coming up with all the details, and who the speaker, and where we're going to be, and what night we're going to have it, and blah, blah, blah. And while we're at this girl's house, my friend Kathy's house, her daughter comes home, and her daughter's 18 years old, and she's just taken a job at this swimming school. So all of a sudden, don't ask me how, this is how the group conscious works all the time, but I know we're having a SCAC planning meeting. The next thing I know, there's eight of us in the room, three of us do not know how to swim. The other five have taken a group conscious and decided that the three of us need to learn how to swim. You know, so they signed us up for swimming lessons. You know, now at this point, I'm in my 30s. One of the other gals was in her 40s. Other gal was in her 50s. You know, and none of us had ever, you know, learned how to swim, didn't know how to swim. It was a pretty terrifying experience for us, and we were pretty petrified about it. But the group thought that, you know, it was time for us to learn how to swim, face our fear. You know, like I say, they took a group conscious, they signed us up, and the three of us show up at the first day for swimming school, and we were rigged for it. We were ready to go. And we were prepared that there would be lots of small children there because it's a swimming school, and it's the lucky duck swimming school. I mean, let's face it. It's not really, you know, the adults who never learned how to swim swimming school. It's the lucky duck swimming school. And so we show up, and all the little kids are there, and we were prepared for that, but we weren't prepared for their parents to be there. You know, now that freaked us all out, you know, because there's all these parents in the, you know, the people that are our age and, you know, that are in the bleachers there, you know,
encouraging their children, we were just totally unprepared for that. And I remember we were in there, we were putting on our swimming suits, we were a nervous wreck, and Gloria, who was the oldest of us, who was in her 50s at the time, you know, she has one of those still 50s kind of swimming suits, you know, with the little built-in bra thing they used to do in the little skirt and all that stuff, and she's putting on her swimming suit, and she walks up to me, and she's like, she's a nervous wreck, and she goes, well, how do I look, you know, and you know, it has a little built-in bra, so she's got the little perky breast thing going up here, and I'm like, I said, you look fabulous, and she goes, well, how come my breasts are down here, you know? And I'm like, well, pick them up and put them in those holders you got, you know? You know, but it's the laughter that was able to get us out in the pool in the first place. You know, and then I remember the three of us standing on the side, and then here's our instructor who's like 12. You know, I mean, this does not help the situation any at all. And what happened is one more time, willingness went out and fear took over. You know, just total fear took over. And we all kind of huddled together. We took our own three-person non-swimmer group conscience, you know, and decided that this was really way beyond any length that we should have to go to. And so we just told the instructor, we're not ready. And we kind of scurried in, you know, to change our clothes. And we changed our clothes and we're outside. Now, I had brought my son with me and my youngest son, who at that point was about, you know, 10, 11 years old. And, you know, because I had a little kid, he went with me to lots of Al-Anon meetings, tons of Al-Anon meetings, and he went with me a lot of places that I went, and he'd happened to go with me for swimming lessons, and so we're standing out there, the three of us are talking how, you know, this is just way too embarrassing, and this is not what we had in mind, and blah, 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 you know, and then as the three of us are standing around, my 10-year-old son, you know, who pipes up, you know, well, I thought in Al-Anon, we don't care what other people think. And the little boogers only hear crap, you know, when it's convenient for them to, you know, shove it back in your face. So the three of us, you know, we stood there, and we did the serenity prayer, we went back in, and we took our very first swimming lesson. And we, all three of us, I am proud to tell you, I'm a graduate of the Lucky Duck Swim School. I know, it was wonderful. But as we started going, our friends started coming, and my sponsor would come and stuff, and my sponsor was sitting up in the bleachers one time when we were having our swimming lesson, and she said, one of the other mothers of the little children, you know, tapped her on the arm and said, which one is yours? And the other gal between Gloria and I is Kathy, and Kathy is besides being an Al-Anon, is also an Alcoholics Anonymous. Not that it's a requirement, but you know she was tattooed, and at that time when you know people weren't tattooed and stuff, and so Carol said the one with the tattoo. And it got to, you know, one more time, you know, other people, everybody, the support you get here, it wasn't even just the people that came from Al-Anon that supported us while we were learning how to swim, you know, and facing our fear and having that willingness to do that, but it was the other parents that were there. Because, see, when you're taking swimming lessons on a regular schedule, you start taking swimming lessons with the same little kids whose parents are there. And you hear the parents, and they're clapping, and every time they see you do anything, they're cheering for you. Way to go, Larcine. Yeah, you blow those bubbles, girl. You know, I mean, and it's just, you know, and it's there. It is absolutely positively there. And then the parents that would come up to us and say, you know, and we think they're judging us and that, you know, it's embarrassing and humiliating. And all they said to us is, you know, we thought, you know, how brave to, you know, face your fear and get in there and try and do that kind of stuff. But, you know, our mind will take us to the backside that it's a bad thing that we're doing when in reality it's a good thing you're doing and you get lots of support. There's lots of support out there. But if you tell people the truth about what's going on, I have yet to be anywhere in any group of people when I have said what's honestly going on, that I haven't been, you know, had all the love and support that I could use, whether or not I'm in the program, you know, or around program people or not in program people. It's my real belief, and I've learned in Al-Anon, that most people's core is good. You know, that everybody really does want to be helpful. You know, and if you give people the opportunity to do that, you will find that. You know, and one more time, it's just willingness to just reach out a little bit. You know, and sometimes you do get hurt, no doubt about it. Sometimes you trust somebody and they slap you right back in the face for it. You know, but whose issue is that? You know, is it you really yours or is it theirs? You know, don't ever not trust people because someone else is, you know, a fool or an idiot or whatever. You know, if you're coming from the right place, that's all you need to know. And that's all you need to be doing. You know, the other thing, you know, again, in strength for me is powerlessness. You know, and that was huge for me, recognizing my own powerlessness and stuff. Because personally, when I came into Al-Anon, I believed myself to be very powerful because I make things happen. I make people do stuff they don't want to do all the time, basically because they're small children and they do not have a choice. But I make it. I make our family go to the park. I make a hungover drunk get in the car, you know, two screaming kids that don't want anything to do with it, screaming boys, because by God, we're going to a laundry park so everybody else can see that we're a normal family. You know, I make that kind of stuff happen, and I mistake that for power. You know, I mistake bullying, you know, and being bossy and ranting and raving at people and talking at them until their eyes roll back in their head and they surrender because they just can't take it anymore. And I call that, and I say I have power. You know, and I don't have any kind of power. You know, a couple things that have happened to me. I talked about my sister Lucy, the one that's 13 months behind me, the one that was a chronic runaway and stuff. And my sister, she and I were really close. We always were super, super close. And I'm the oldest, and she was just 13 months behind me. And because we moved a lot, we were always like best friends, because when you move a lot, especially in the Army, you know, we were just very close. And but she was the complete opposite. We were the complete opposite of each other, but we really had this real devotion for each other and a lot of love for each other. And you know, and it was just like, and I was always the bossy sister. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. My sister was very outgoing and gregarious, and she would, whenever we'd move to a new place, she'd go round up all the neighborhood kids. I would select who would be my friends, and she got the leftovers. You know, that's just kind of how it worked. You know, we were really big back then, Barbie and Ken, all that kind of stuff. I was always Barbie, she was always Ken. That's just the way it was. You know, when we were playing Barbie, she had to be Ken, and she wore that suit, and we were just close. We were just really close. And then, of course, as we got older, and then she started doing the runaway thing and stuff, you know, we just grew apart. And then my sister started doing drugs and alcohol, you know, and I believe my sister became an alcoholic, you know, and a drug addict, and she had a really hard road to go, and my sister was a chronic liar and in all kinds of trouble, and one time I went with her because she had to go to court for shoplifting. You know, she's an adult woman, and I had to go with her when she had to go to court for shoplifting, and she'd given so many names, she'd lied about it so much, it was hysterical. The judge is up there, Lucy Jones, Lucy Smith, Lucy Wells, Lucy Brewer, well, the real Lucy, please stand up, you know, I mean, and my sister was just, I mean, she did these things, but she was so funny when she did them. I just loved to watch her. She was just an absolute joy to be around. But she did really hurtful things to herself and a lot of painful stuff. And she ended up getting married to another guy that did just as much drugs as she did. She has two boys the same age as my two boys. When she was 30, about 35 years old or something, I got a call. I remember I just finished filling out Christmas cards that night, and I'd done the last Christmas card. And then I'd gone to sleep, and the phone rang about 2 o'clock in the morning. My mom called me. My mom was hysterical on the other end because my sister had been killed in an accident. And that was a really painful, painful time for me. My sister was drunk in the car with her husband and two other drunk people. There was a single car accident because my sister and her husband were fighting and hitting each other in the back seat. The driver turned around to yell at them and hit an embankment. The car flipped over. And of course, four drunk people in the car, nobody has a seatbelt on. And my sister was thrown from the car, and that didn't kill her, but the car rolled all back over and squished her brain. And that was the end of my sister. And she was really practicing and doing her thing. And she had gone to Narcotics Anonymous for a little while when she was up in Oregon. And we would talk back and forth, and I was so happy and blah, 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 because, of course, she got the message. She moved away from where her sponsor lived to another spot, and she started doing the drinking, using thing again. But I know that when my sister died, we were on good terms with each other, because I loved her. I learned to love her unconditionally, just the way she was. And I knew that, you know, that she suffered from a disease. And it was really, really hard for me. But the powerlessness part came for me that night because, first of all, when I got the call that my sister was dead, my sister lies so much that I would not put it past her to say she died. I mean, she's done it before. You know, if it works for her, she'll do it. And if she thinks it'll get her some money or some whatever. So I made my husband call up to Oregon, call up to this town that she was supposedly living, call the state police there. And he came back and he verified the fact that, yes, she'd been killed in this accident. And I was overcome with grief, just totally overcome with grief. And I remember going in the bathroom and shutting the door and it was incredible. And I remember falling to my knees, and I don't mean to be so weepy about this, but, oh well, I know, really, but anyway, I remember falling to my knees and asking God just to please help me. I didn't ask him to make my sister be alive again, because I knew that wasn't a fair prayer. I just asked him to help me, and I felt just for a flash of a second, this absolutely overwhelming presence that just told me my sister was okay.
They just told me it was okay. And see, and what I didn't tell you that happened just prior to that is, like I said, I'd been making out Christmas cards that night. And of course, I got to finish them all because I'm task-oriented. You know, I don't go to bed till the last stamp is on and they are all done and everybody's got a check by their name. And I'm laying in bed and my husband's long asleep and I remember just dozing off to sleep. And then I remember about, maybe about 1 o'clock in the morning, I felt something. My eyes were closed, but I felt something like right this close in front of my face, so much so that it startled me, and I woke up. And I woke up my husband, and I said, God, I just felt like there was this presence in the room. You know, and what I know tonight from that moment, that God shed this light on me, was that was my sister visiting me before she left. I know she'd been killed, and she was leaving, and she stopped by to see me before she went up to the big place or wherever she gets to go in the sky. You know, I believe that with all my heart. Because when I was on my knees in the bathroom that second, and I asked God to help me, I just felt this light that just said she was okay. She wasn't alive anymore, but she was okay. And just as fast as it came, it went. And it was gone. But, I know. I hold on to that second every time I think about her. That she's okay and she's where she's supposed to be in another place. I'm not happy about it. Al-Anon has never, ever told me that it's okay. I don't mean to come here and say, that it's not okay. It's just plain old, when people die of the disease of alcoholism, it is not okay. It is a sucky deal. There is absolutely no doubt about it. But it is the way that it is. And nothing is going to change that. Nothing is going to make it be any different. So I know when I get my chance to go to heaven, the first thing I'm going to do is kick her butt when I get up there, because I am not happy about it. I am not happy about it. But I get past it. There's things, you never get over certain things. There's just certain things you never get over, but you do get past things. When I think about Lucy, I remember her in good terms. I don't remember her dying a drug addict and an alcoholic. That's not who my sister was. My sister was funny, and she was a good person, and the disease of alcoholism kills people. That's the worst that can happen, and it happens. So anyway, enough of that stuff. Now we'll go from my sister dying to my son's doing drugs, a little happier event, okay? again, because these are the stories I have to tell you about my powerlessness. And I told you a little bit last night about my oldest boy and his stuff and his turmoil. And we went through lots with him. He was arrested for possession of cocaine, drunk driving. They got kicked out of school, had to go to continuation high school. It was just a huge ordeal for me, and I was struggling with it. And I was even struggling all the more because, like I say, I'm good at faking it. And I knew I wasn't handling it well. So instead of sharing with my sponsor, and my group, that I was having any kind of difficulties with it, what I started doing instead was I started acting like everything was okie-dokie. I'm doing really well. Yes, he's still doing his stuff, but I'm working my program. And one more time, I start living the lie that's active alcoholism. I just start living that lie again because I don't understand why I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And so therefore, I must be doing something wrong, and God forbid I should let you know that I'm struggling. Because I've been coming to Al-Anon, 10, 12, 13 years now? I'm supposed to know better. So I quit sharing that stuff with the group. And then what happened? Then I started becoming just, nasty at home, yelling, screaming at everybody, ranting, raving, trying to control and manipulate, doing all this stuff. And I remember what happened one night is on Thursday nights, my husband goes to an AA meeting that's down the street from my Al-Anon meeting. And so usually what I do is I drop him off at his Al-Anon meeting, and I go, or his AA meeting, and then I go off to my Al-Anon meeting, then I come back and pick him up. And he loves, we don't do that anymore because we go to different meetings now. But he used to love that because I'd drop him off at his AA meeting and all the AA guys would be standing outside. And then I'd start to drive away and I'd hear him go, and you go to that Al-Anon meeting and you listen to what those people are telling you. Yeah, honey. And then you walk into the meeting all puffy chested, But this one particular night, I drop him off, and it's been bad at our house. It's been really bad at our house because of me. And he never says anything to me. Like I say, my husband's a laid-back guy, and he works his own program. He lets me work my own program. But he says to me when I drop him off, he goes, I really hope you share at that meeting because you need to share with those people about what's going on in your life. I told him what I always do, mind your own freaking business. This is my program. You work your program. Thank you very much for sharing. Because one more time, see, I don't get it from him. I do not get it from him. I'm not listening to what he's telling me, because you don't get it from your family members. And I had absolutely no intention of sharing anything at that meeting that night. But when I got to the meeting that night, guess what? The leader didn't show up, and they asked if I'd take the leader's place. So I start leading the meeting, and then I start reading the opening. And then for the very first time, I've been in Al-Anon 12, 13 years at this point, and I read the part about how it says, how we become nervous and irritable without knowing it. Why? Because we try and force solutions. What was I doing one more time? Because, see, I couldn't stand the thought of my child having this disease. I had a dad and a sister and a husband. See, I personally think there ought to be a 3 alcoholic limit per person. Don't you think? Does that sound fair or what? You know, but, you know, I think that ought to be the deal, you know. And I've had my 3, and I'm sorry, I can't do this again, you know. And so, and because I read what I was doing, I was trying to force solutions. I was trying to make, you know, these people act the way that I want them to act, and I do not have that power. I am powerless. So that night, I got to share with the group how I was one more time living the lie. You know, and one more time, no one criticized me. No one said, Larsine, you idiot, you fool. Well, you do, guys, what you always do when someone comes and surrenders their self. You know, you put your arms around them, keep coming back. We love you. This too shall pass. We're here for you. You know, I don't know how it's going to end. No one said it's going to end happily ever after. You know, or no one makes fake promises like that to us. What they tell me is that no matter what your family does, you can be happy. You can be happy if you want to be happy here. You know, but you got to look to yourself. You just got to be, it's your job to be the best mom. It's their job to live their life the way that they need to do it. You know, and the powerless thing is a big deal for me. You know, and the same thing with them. It's really been hard for me. My sponsor made me a 3-minute rule when I'm talking to my boys when they were living at home. Because like I say, I will talk to them until their eyes roll back in their head. And they hear nothing. You know, when I'm in there just going, garbage, 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 you know, because I'm trying to save their life. You know, and it's so important that I make them understand. You know, and all they see is they see their mother, who they could give a rat's, you know what, about what my opinion is about what's going on, because they're teenage boys and they're going to do what they're going to do. And so what my sponsor did is she gave me the 3-minute rule. Because as a parent, I do have an opinion, and I have a right to that opinion. And as a parent, sometimes it's important for me to let them know when I see them doing something wrong, that I need to point out to them that they are doing something wrong. But what my sponsor gave me, the 3-minute rule, I got 3 minutes to go in there and say how I feel. 3 minutes, and if I can't do it in 3 minutes, then I got nothing else to say. It's no more, because when I start arguing with them, that's what it turns into. Then the next thing you know, I'm defending why it's okay for me, a woman in my 40s, to have a glass of wine at dinner. That's how the argument turns around for them. You know, when they're getting arrested and they're underage and they're doing drugs, I mean, it's ridiculous how this thing turns around. So now I have the 3-minute deal. And as adults today, if I really think there's something going on and I feel compelled to have to talk to them, you know, I tell them, this may be none of my business, but as your mother, you know, I really feel I have to say this to you. And I do my 3-minute thing, take what you like and leave the rest. But I feel like I've done what my part is in it. I don't ignore what's going on. I don't pretend that it's not going on. But I say my 3-minute deal and then I'm done. And then it's over for me. And I know that I've done what it's my responsibility to do. Whether or not they act on that information or not is totally up to them. And sometimes they've turned that 3-minute deal around on me. You know, and I'm like, you know, because I think I'm perfect all the time, you know, and then, well, Mom, you've been doing this and this, and it's really made me feel uncomfortable, and you said this to me in front of so-and-so, and that hurt my feelings, you know, and stuff, and I've needed to hear that and be quiet when they have their 3 minutes with me. You know, because that's what it's about, open communication. And that's why we have unconditional love in our house today, because we really feel like we can talk to each other without being judged anymore. And that's a gift that you guys gave me, an absolute positive gift that you guys gave me. You know, the next kind of a deal here is, you know, is action. You know, and God knows I'm a person of action. You know, and what I really should say is reaction. You know, if you guys heard my driver's license story last night, you know, I mean, I am just off and running. Because I don't need to know the facts. I just need this much information, and boy, I'm off. I can figure out everything else that goes on. And, you know, a story I like to tell on myself is when we were on one of our famous hiking trips, we were up in the Tetons and stuff. It wasn't the Tetons, it was Zion. We were between Zion and Bryson, and it was the summertime. And Zion and Bryson, there's a lot of bugs, and I am bug phobia. I do not like insects of any kind, which is why we have a motorhome, because I will not sleep on the ground where insects can even begin to get near me. And so I have this giant bug phobia thing going on, and everywhere there's centipedes and, oh, ugly things with these things and, you know, and clipper things, and I just am like, at the end of this hiking day, I am flipped out. I am flipped out. So we're back to campsite, end of the day, we've eaten dinner, now we're doing the marshmallow roast thing around the fire. Now, I feel something cold slide down my neck into my bra. Now, I mean, my whole day has been like this, so I am just like, woohoo, you know, and I'm ripping off my clothing. You know, other campers are coming over to see the show because I am screaming bloody murder, and I'm just jumping up and down, and my husband and my boys around me, my husband, I go, it's in my bra, you know. My husband's digging in there trying to find it, and he gets it out, back of my earrings come undone. Yes, it was the treacherous earring monster bug, and, you know, and I have to know that I get startled a lot of times today, but I try and think, wait, before you panic and scream and put on a show, let's see what it is first, you know, and because I am, I'm a reactor, you know, and again, it's in my DNA too. It's part of who I am. I always overreact to the situation that's going on. And granted, there were things to lead up to that to the end of that day. But if I had just really taken a breath and then just see what's happening, you know, because sometimes it looks like there's an emergency over here and it turns out not to be an emergency, you know, but I'll make it one. And that's what I will do, left to my own devices. I will take something that, you know, it could or could not happen. Let's just kind of see where it goes and then let it go. And, you know, because one more time, first know the facts. Tell me everything and then we'll go from there. You know, and this is a program of action. And basically for me too, what I've had to learn to do here, it's not the next thing, because I'm good at doing. I'll do whatever next thing it is. I'll fill in the next thing. You know, you yell, my next thing, yell back at you. You know, but what I've learned in Al-Anon is what's the next right thing to do? The next right thing to do. And the huge word here, right. The next right thing to do. And that's what I have to think about sometimes. What is the next right thing to do? If someone's upset and yelling, is the next right thing to do to yell back at them? Or maybe should I just kind of diffuse that situation by just being quiet? Doesn't mean I have to accept somebody else's bad behavior. I'm just not going to participate in it. I don't like it, but I don't have to participate in it, so I don't have to keep that next wrong behavior going on and on and on. And that's become a big thing for me. What's the next right thing to do? And it's made a big deal for me. And one more time I've gotten out of that is a 10-second rule. And because my automatic response is I want to say something right now, right now. And now I got the 10-second rule. When I feel myself get hot and mad, 10 seconds, no talking. And then what I do with that 10 seconds instead is say, God help me. That doesn't even take 10 seconds. And sometimes I have to say it twice. But it's just, God help me. You know, they say, you know, God keep your arm, you know, when God's helping you, there's a prayer about, you know, God, please put one shoulder around my arm and the other one over my mouth. You know, because I need to be quiet here. I don't need to participate in this negative behavior. And I've been able to do that because of the 10-second rule. You know, and that's all. And it's not that I'm letting that person have their way, and I had to get past that thing. I'm not letting someone have their way. I'm choosing a life of serenity and peace. That's my choice, and I'm not going to let you take it away from me. And if just 10 seconds gives that back to me, it's worth it. It is absolutely, positively worth it. You know, and we're asked to do certain things that require action here. You know, you got to go to meetings. That's action. You got to get your butt off the chair and go to meetings. You got to, you know, work the steps. You know, be of service. You know, when they need volunteers. You know, when it's time to be secretary. You don't have to do it all the time, but you need to take your turn. You know, and I don't take on the guilt of the whole meeting. I'm sure you don't have this happen in Indianapolis. But I tell you, in California, nobody wants to volunteer for crapola at the meeting, you know, because I did this and I did that and I did that. And it's not my job anymore to look around the room and say who's been this or who's been that. It's just my job to say, is it my turn to do it? You know, and if it's my turn to do it, I raise my hand. And that's the bottom line, because I have to take action in my own recovery. And if it's my turn to do it, then it's my turn to do it. And if I start justifying in my head why it's not my turn to do it, then it's probably my turn to do it. You know, because I want to get out of it, because I don't particularly like that job or whatever. But I don't know what adventure will open up for me if I get to do that. I hate setup, because it means you have to be there early, and you have to set up the chairs and do all that kind of stuff. And I just don't like the job. You know, but it's funny, every time I've done setup, I've just gotten so much out of it. Newcomers show up early, you know, because they don't know where the meeting is, and you know how anal we are, we got to be there 5 hours early because we want to make sure we're in the right place. And I've had some of the best conversations and met some of the best newcomer people I've met in my entire life just because I was willing to be there and set up the chairs. You know, I don't know what the package is going to bring, but I've got to be willing to take the action. You know, working the steps, service work, all of that stuff requires action on our part. And it doesn't have to be a lot. We don't have to overdo it. You know, we were talking today about, you know, finding balance, you know, and doing those kinds of things. And anyway, action is a huge part. You know, the next deal for me is the steps. You know, that's where I get a lot of strength from. And they're in order for a reason. You know, and another thing I know about the steps is they're here to help you. They're not to hurt you. But boy, I used to think they were there to hurt me. You know, it was just like I would be reading ahead, you know, and it was just like, oh my God, you know, and that's why you work them in order. You know, if you're reading about making amends, that's going to freak you out when you're new. So don't go there. You know, stay with number one. Number eight's way over there, you know, so let it be way over there. You'll get there when you're supposed to get there. And if you work them in order, then the next one is just the next right thing to do. So it naturally comes in order. I'm not going to sit here and try and go through all the steps with you and all that stuff. You know, there's just as many ways to work this program as there are people in it. You know, and you work the steps the way that you need to work them, but the deal is that you need to work them. You know, and you don't need to sit there and be stuck, and you don't have to be that way. If you're having trouble, you ask your sponsor, you ask other people. You go to step study meetings, you read about it, and you do whatever. But the steps are the program. Don't disillusion yourself. You know, going to meetings is not the program. Working the steps is what the really program is about. That's how your life gets changed when you start saying, I am powerless over alcohol. Well, what does powerless mean? See, I had a hell of a time with the first step because what? I'm not powerless over alcohol. I am not. No. You know, and stuff. And then that's what I focus on because I just want to see those words, you know, and stuff. But I keep going to meetings and I hear people talk about it. And my sponsor said, you're going to take out the word alcohol and you're going to replace it with the word alcoholic. You're going to replace it with the word other people, places, and things. Those are things you're powerless over. You know, and again, coming and listening to what people are telling me, how to work the steps. You know, it's the actions that we take that teach us how to act differently. You know, to have the courage to do that. And to me, the steps give me everything. They've given me everything. They've given me a God of my understanding. They've given me back myself by doing my fourth and my fifth step. They've given me other people back by making amends. You know, and they give me the ability to be of service, you know, to myself and to God and to my fellows, you know, because of the way that we talk, the 12th step, carrying this message to others, practicing these principles in all our affairs. That means everything you do. And your life gets better when you practice it in everything you do. It's a big deal. And then service, you know, and I tell people, if you're into service, service is its own reward. If you're looking for somebody to pat you on the back, forget about it, especially in Al-Anon, because we got a lot of people with notebooks about how you're supposed to do it and how they did it. And we are such overachievers here. I always feel bad for the people that have to do any fundraising thing because you got to beat the guys before you. How much did they raise last year? You know, and that's the mark that we set for ourselves. And, you know, and it's not what it's about. It is not absolutely what it's about. It's just about doing the very best you can. You know, I watched, you know, people didn't want to take on the raffle commitment because it was too hard. You know, the way it was going, you know, it would be like, okay, in 2012, somebody's going to have to raise $1 million. I mean, that's the number now, you know, and stuff, because we just keep pushing and pushing, and it's not about that. It's about being self-sufficient. It's about the deal paying for itself. And when that got pointed out to me, service became fun again. But when it's a goal, you know, when you think that you have to meet this thing, you have to beat these other people, you know, you drive yourself out of that stuff. And it's my character defect. It's definitely my character defect, controlling, knowing what's best for everybody. Don't you just hate it when you're going to your meeting? And I've been on vacation, and I've come back, and while I was on vacation, that group took a group conscience and changed something about the meeting while I was gone. That irritates the bejeebies out of me. You know, how dare they change something while I was gone? But maybe it's for the better. I don't always know. Why don't I try it for a while? Maybe I'll like what they came up with. You know, but again, we were talking today. You know, Al-Anon is full of sick people. I mean, that's the bottom line, you know, we're full of a lot of sick people, and what are our issues? Control, manipulation, you know, those are the things we all bring to the party and stuff, and we do a real disservice to others because we turn them away from service. You know, when you're so controlling about your job, or if you're the chairman of a specific committee, and it has to be your way, and you don't open yourself up to, you know, letting other people have some input into it, you wonder why they don't want to do it anymore. You wonder why they don't want to raise their hands, because we turn them away from it. It has to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. Every group's autonomous. You can take a group conscience. You know, it doesn't have to. Just try and stay open-minded about that kind of stuff. And service at the group level. You know, what stops me from raising my hand? You know, one more time, because I don't want to do it with so-and-so because she's so bossy and pushy and blah, blah, blah. When in reality, she's more bossy and pushy than I am. You know, and that's the issue that I'm having to deal with. You know, and then another thing about service I can't stress enough is, are you having fun? You need to have fun in service, and you can if you let it be fun. If you make it be a job, it's like any other job. You're back to cleaning toilets again. You know, it's just like if you let it be fun, if you let, you know, the opportunity to get to work with other people. So try a job you don't know that you've never done before. How scary can it be? You know, we do a thing at our South Bay Roundup that is just hysterical. There's this guy, and he's kind of like a semi kind of comic actor guy, too. But he does Literature Man, you know, and he shows up, you know, before one of the meetings, and he's got all the literature stuffed in his pockets, and he does this big monologue with the newcomer, you know, and what it's really about is the enthusiasm of having the job. You know, and when you're sitting there going, God, I'm the literature person, that means I have to go, you know, and put all this stuff out. I hate it. But then when you hand a piece of literature to somebody and they thank you and you help somebody, boy, the rewards you get from that. You know, and when you're the smiling literature person at the table, it's kind of conducive to newcomers when there's a person smiling there. We had birthday night at our meeting last Monday night, and we had a lot of birthdays. June is a big month. We probably had 18, 20 birthdays. And we have a sunshine person who's in charge of doing the cards. Well, she has a limit of 10 birthdays per meeting, because after the 10th birthday, you could tell she was getting ticked off. There were too many flaming birthday cards going around. She didn't have enough pins or clipboards, you know, and stuff like that. So, and we do what we do. We just started laughing about it, you know, because you know why? She got the look, you know, and everybody recognized the look, so we all started picking on her about it, and so she was able to laugh about it, you know, and make it be fun again. Let service be fun. You know, whatever you do, just let it be fun. Have a good time here. God wants us to have a good time here. It's not supposed to be a burden. It's just not supposed to be a burden. And then traditions. God, I hated the traditions. Boy, when you're new, tradition night, I'm skipping tradition night. You know, it's just like it just doesn't apply to me. You know, because it's all about like the work of the pro, you know, how the meetings run, how the groups work, and all that other kind of stuff. I just really didn't like it. I thought it was dumb. I never read them, you know, other than, you know, we didn't read them at the meeting either. They were, you know, listed there next to the steps, but nobody ever paid much attention to them, at least at the meetings I went to in the beginning. You know,